welcome back to Radio Times. The shooting death of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman in Florida last month has sparked outrage across the country. Zimmerman, who was a member of a town watch, had been tracking Martin through his neighborhood and talking with the police department. Even though the officer told him to back off, Zimmerman confronted the unarmed team and shot him, claiming self-defense. Zimmerman was questioned by the police and released. President Obama was asked about the incident last Friday in the White House Rose Garden.
But my main message is to the parents of Trayvon Martin. You know, if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. And, you know, I think they are right to expect that all of us, as Americans, are going to take this with the seriousness it deserves and that we're going to get to the bottom of exactly what happened.
This tragic story has raised a whole host of troubling and important questions about race, gun laws, and civil rights. Our topic for today's Radio Times, and we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Anthony Murphy is Executive Director of Town Watch Integrated Services, training and supporting over 700 neighborhood watch groups here in the Philadelphia area. Anthony Murphy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. James Peterson is the Director of Africana Studies, also Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, a blogger for Huffington Post. And James Peterson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. And here for joining us as well is David Rudofsky. He's a civil rights lawyer here in Philadelphia at Carey's Rudofsky, Messing and Feinberg. He's also a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. And David, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning.
James, let me begin with you. Could Trayvon Martin be your son?
He absolutely could, and in fact, that's the power of the president's comments in that he connects what has become a national and international story to the personal and to the private for him. And it's interesting to think about some of the responses to the president's comments by folk like Mr. Gingrich, who try to criticize him for personalizing and he would say racializing it. This is the height of hypocrisy, right? Because we talk about race all the time, and folk in the Republican Party, especially in the candidacy process, have been talking about race in certain coded terms. So the president here, I thought, was resonant, and he rose to the challenge of the moment in the sense that people are anguished and outraged at this particular case.
Well, and interesting, David, that it's been a month since this case, and it slowly has sort of gathered momentum as people have begun to pay attention to it. You're someone who's been involved in civil rights issues for years. What strikes you about this particular case?
Well, you know, what's interesting here is, you know, the debate that's really sparked this is the so-called stand your ground statute. And that's an interesting question, you know, that whole question of when you can use self-defense and when you can't. Historically, the notion of self-defense is necessity. Only use deadly force when it's really necessary to protect yourself or others. Whatever your position is on that, where, you know, whether it's the castle, the home, where you don't have to retreat, or the street where you don't have to retreat, what strikes me about this case, at least from what we know so far, it's not stand your ground. Zimmerman was the provocateur, right? He was the one that provoked this. He stopped him illegally. Trayvon was doing nothing illegal. He was the one that invoked it. And even under the Florida law, he loses his right to use self-defense, deadly self-defense.
But the officers applied it. Obviously, they applied it because he hasn't been arrested.
That's right. And because you look at the language of the statute, you have immunity. It's not only a troublesome statute, and we can talk about that, but their application was even worse, because even under the terms of the statute, he should have been arrested.
Well, let me turn to you, Anthony, because you trained Town Watch volunteers to go out and, I guess, be the eyes and ears of the police department. From what you know, what did Zimmerman do?
From what I know,
from what's been
reported, he did everything wrong. One, you don't go out on Town Watch as a single individual. You go out with a partner. That's one. That's one. Two, you don't carry any weapons when you go out on patrol. None. You don't carry mace, even if you're walking the street. Your job is to be to observe, document, and report. Number three, he got out of his vehicle to confront him. You are a citizen. He's a citizen. You don't have the right to do that. It is a call to 911 that you make. You make that call. You can stress what you consider is suspicious behavior. You make the observation. You make a good description. And you leave it to the police to respond. I was appalled at his actions. And also, I wanted to point out that according to the National Sheriff's Association, he's not a registered neighborhood watch member. Okay? See, so I want to put that out there because they connect neighborhood watch and town watch, although it's somewhat different, town watch being the Philadelphia flavor, neighborhood watch, he's not registered to the U.S. Town Sheriff's Association. So he broke a lot of the rules. And when you break those rules, it's always a tragedy. The unfortunate part is that because of his view of a young black male, and let's also be clear that it wasn't raining initially when he observed him, mm-hmm. and when it started to rain, he put his hoodie on. Right. I'm sorry, this is America. He has a right to wear a hoodie. He has a right. I mean, if we have gained any ground, we must gain and understand those rights have to be observed, and he stepped over the boundary.
Mm-hmm. I do want to play that 9/11 tape, a portion of it, but let me first turn to you, James, because you were on the radio. You have your hoodie on.
Yes, I
do. In solidarity with Trayvon?
Absolutely, and I think you're right that it's not about the hoodie, but wearing the hoodie and the hoodie marches that are going on are sort of emblematic of the arbitrary nature of this crime. And so if you can be shot just for being black, or if you're suspicious just because you're wearing a hoodie, we have to cry out against that. We're living in a society where there's a culture of fear, where there are biases in our institutions, and sadly, those biases manifest themselves in individuals, and that's what the crime is in this particular case. An individual had the same kind of biases that we fight against, and unfortunately, Mr. Zimmerman took Mr. Martin's life.
You have a son about to turn 13. Have
yes.
you had quote-unquote, that talk with him?
Well, so there's this thing called the talk that you have with young black children, especially young black men, about how to conduct themselves in public spaces because of these kinds of cases. Now, for me personally, it's an ongoing conversation. I have to talk to my son repeatedly over time to make him understand. He's scared and frightened by this case. He doesn't understand it. My daughter's also frightened, and they don't understand it as well. So we have to sort of encourage them not to be fearful, but to be more vigilant and more aware of the society that we live in.
And even for me, I speak to young men all the time, even on the basketball court, because they get out, you play, and that's how you interact with them and how you give them guidance. So we're constantly having the conversation about how to carry yourself, how to behave, how to even respond when the police stop you, so
right.
that we don't have that as an issue. We realize that here and now, there's a point of being very specific about what to do. And if now you're saying you can't wear a hoodie, I can't wear a hoodie because I'm black. They'll sell it to me, but I can't wear it. Mm. With the stereotypes that people do or the things that we have to work against, we have to work against them consistently. And then even when you talk about the culture of fear, in America, it's a culture of violence.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to work to eradicate the culture of violence. And that's what is prompting us. It's not fear that caused him to react that way. It's the culture that says, I have a right as a male of a different persuasion, of a different you to go out and invoke my own beliefs on someone else. And that's what took Trayvon Martin's life.
Let me play this tape. We got about 2 minutes of this 9/11 911 tape, and this is between George Zimmerman and the police department in Florida. Let's listen.
Hey, we've had some break-ins in my neighborhood, and there's a real suspicious guy. It's Retrieve View Circle. The best address I can give you. This guy looks like he's up to no good, or he's on drugs or something. It's raining, and he's just walking around looking about.
Okay, and this guy, is he white, black, or Hispanic?
He looks black.
Did you see what he was wearing?
Yeah, a dark hoodie, like a gray hoodie, and either jeans or sweatpants and white tennis shoes. He's here now. He's just staring.
Oh, he's just walking
looking
around the area?
At all the houses.
Okay.
Now he's just staring at me.
Okay. He said
that's the clubhouse.
That's the clubhouse. Do you know what he's near the clubhouse right now?
Yeah, now he's coming towards me.
Okay.
He's got his hand in his waistband. And he's a black male.
Okay. How old would you say he looks?
He's got a button on his shirt. Late teens.
Late teens, okay.
Mm-hmm. Something's wrong with him. Yeah, he's coming to check me out. He's got something in his hands. I don't know what his deal is.
Okay, just let me know if he does anything, okay?
Officer over here.
Yeah, we got him on the way. Just let me know if this guy does anything else.
Okay. They always get away. Down towards the entrance of the neighborhood.
Okay, which entrance is that he's heading towards?
The back entrance.
Are you following him? Yeah. Okay, we don't need you to do that.
Okay.
Again, that's part of that 9/11 call, 911 call that George Zimmerman made before he shot and killed Trayvon Martin. And to you, David Radofsky, there are many things to talk about in that 2 minutes there, but the police officer says, you don't need to do that. We don't want you to follow him.
Well, not only don't follow him, don't provoke something, mm-hmm. but look at the words that he uses. They always get away.
Yeah.
They.
Excuse me. He's up to no good, right? He's got the hoodie, young black man.
Walking. He's walking around and he's up to no good.
It's all the stereotypes. And what catches me, he's about to get away, right? You know, I'm not going to let this kid get away. And yet, nothing criminal going on. Nothing wrong going on.
That's right.
And he thinks he's got a right both to intervene and then to use deadly force when there's resistance at the scene. Very troubling.
Go ahead, Anthony.
See, if he had been properly prepared to do town watch, he would have had a partner with him, number one. They had been talking to not only making the call to 911, but other partners. Because it's not just two people. You do four people. And the reason you do that is so that there can be communications. If I'm with you, mm-hmm. you see it one way. You may see it another way. And that gives me the impetus of being able to address what I see and how I look at it. He wasn't doing anything. No one had called 911. No one had screamed. No one, mm-hmm. no break-in. You do not invoke yourself into the position to become confrontational. That is law enforcement's job. So then when he says young black male, so now he knows he's a young black male, late teens. Mm-hmm. He's up to no good. Well, I'm not sure up to no good is...
What does that mean?
It means you're up to no good because you're walking in my neighborhood, mm-hmm. but there were other people of color, other black people in the neighborhood, so he had a very right to be there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a gated community where it was all white or all Hispanic or all black. It's an integrated neighborhood, so therefore he has rights to be there. He saw no weapon. Oh, his hand's in his pants. Mm-hmm. He's coming up mm-hmm. to me. You were following him. At the point that you cross over the line, you have to step back from the line. So he didn't confront him at the car. He went the other way. It was time for him to stop. Mm-hmm. He didn't, and unfortunately he didn't. Race played a part of that.
Sure. You think it was race? Very quickly.
Sure. We should caution folks about listening to all the tapes. But if you listen to them, what you will see is that this event terrorized that community. Zimmerman's actions actually terrorized the community that he was trying to protect.
And you say that because...
When you listen to the 911 tapes, people are scared, they're ducking, they're saying, get down, did you see this, what's going on? It's terror in that community based upon the so-called neighborhood watch person.
Right. The other calls to 911 by the other neighbors who made calls as well.
Yes.
I mean, and then they're trying to say, again, I haven't seen Trayvon, the pictures that they've shown us versus the pictures of Zimmerman that you see. You see a 17-year-old child versus a grown man. Mm-hmm. I don't think Zimmerman is on the ground screaming.
Right.
And then they said Zimmerman had a broken nose, but there's no medical report to substantiate that.
Well, let's take a very short break, and we are talking about the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, and our guests are Anthony Murphy, James Peterson, and David Radofsky. We'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. You can receive tax deductions for sustaining nonprofits across southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation works with financial advisors and administers donor-advised funds, charitable gift annuities, memorials, and scholarships. The Foundation takes care of all the details, making it easy for you to make a difference forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
The Discover Newsworks Discover the Philadelphia Region sweepstakes. Newsworks.org is giving away great prizes to our Facebook fans. This week, a National Constitution Center family membership and tickets to the Springsteen exhibition. Visit Facebook.com/Newsworks and enter weekly. Share with your friends for extra chances to win. Like Newsworks on Facebook to enter. No purchase necessary. For a complete list of the rules, go to Newsworks.org. Powered by WHYY and you. Smart. Local. News.
What happens when the powerful forces of war, race, and music collide? Novelist Essie Adugin takes a trip to the 1930s to find out in her book, Half-Blood Blues.
I was very interested in this, the Sarah of the Third Reich. You know, these were stories I really hadn't heard before, and it grew out of that.
The story of black jazz musicians in wartime Europe is at the center of this new novel. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the tragic death of Trayvon Martin and the important issues it raises about things like race and gun laws and civil rights. Our guests are James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, Anthony Murphy, Executive Director of Townwatch Integrated Services, and David Rudofsky, a civil rights lawyer here in Philadelphia. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. David, let me take advantage of the fact that you are a civil rights attorney, and we've got these stand your ground laws. As you understand it, what does the law say in Florida?
Right. In Florida, what they did was extend the stand your ground, which is applicable in most states when you're in your house. Basically, for many years, people have said, well, even if you have an ability to retreat, if somebody is using deadly force against you or threatening deadly force in your house, you don't have to retreat. What becomes controversial is the Florida law, which has now been enacted in about 23 states. Pennsylvania's got a modified version of it, in which they've extended that notion of stand your ground or no retreat to the street confrontation. Mm-hmm. So essentially what they're saying is that even though there's this necessity doctrine, we don't want you to kill somebody unless it's absolutely necessary, even if you could retreat in safety, somebody's just yelling at you, somebody's got a knife but they're 50 yards away, if you can retreat with safety, we don't want you using deadly force, even though the other person is the aggressor. So Florida has gone to the extreme, and we know not only the Trayvon Martin case, but there's been a 30% increase in these shootings in Florida over the past 4 or 5 years, in instance, because people think, well, if I get into a confrontation, and if I think the other person is about to use some kind of very serious force, deadly force, I can shoot to kill. Yep. And so what you get, obviously, are situations where you shouldn't use deadly force at all. But as I said before, the real thing here is that even if you agreed with that concept, you know, I don't have to run, right? You know, I don't have to retreat. That's unmanly, right? That's not macho.
Wow.
Right? I mean, even if you agree with that, and that's debatable, here that's not the situation, because even under the Florida law, you lose your right to use self-defense if you've been the one who provoked the incident in the first place.
Yet it's still applied. They still applied the law. Here's the thing. I would love to know.
This is James Peterson.
Yes,
yeah, go ahead.
I would love to dig a little bit deeper here. One, I would love for the legislators who voted for this law to identify the role of the NRA in the lobbying processes, because the NRA is involved across all these different states. I'd also love to know the senators, because we had a lot of Democratic senators, some black Democratic senators in Florida who voted for this law. Come forward and tell us why you did. I mean, Florida's been experiencing a decline in crime. So explain to us the rationale behind voting for this law, and also reveal for us the role that the NRA has played in lobbying for the law.
Let me quote something actually John Timoney wrote in the New York Times over the weekend. He was obviously police commissioner here in Philly, mm-hmm. and also mm-hmm. the former Miami police chief as well, writing, he says, trying to control shootings by members of a well-trained and disciplined police department is a daunting enough task.
Right.
Laws like Stand Your Ground give citizens unfettered power and discretion with no accountability. It's a recipe for disaster.
Yep. Yep.
And I'm looking at you, Anthony. I'm sure you work closely with police departments,
yes.
and a lot of police departments are very concerned about these stand your ground type laws.
Absolutely. One of the things that if their duty is to apprehend, and therefore the DA's office does prosecution. When you're the citizen in your arm, what do you have? You feel power. You can't carry a gun and not want to use the gun. That is kind of like the macho thing to do, which is why if you're addressing the type of shootings that take place on most urban streets, where you have guns being used illegally, unnecessarily, and then you pass a law that says, hey, it's all right for you to do it as long as you feel that you're threatened. That's taking it too far. It's taking us back to a time to when we did not have any laws. It's taking us to a point to where shoot to kill becomes what you do normally and naturally. I understand that people want to protect themselves, and there's many ways to do that. And what you do in order to protect yourself is first you try not to put yourself in a situation to where you are threatened. You don't walk down the street counting your money. You don't run around at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning being outrageous. There's just things you do not do. And nor should you be allowed to stop a young man or young woman on the street who's doing nothing, or even if they're doing something, and wind up killing them when you're not law enforcement.
Well, James, there's even some interesting research that says that if you're carrying a gun, you have an increased perception that the person that you perceive as threatening you is right. also carrying a gun, yes. even if they don't.
Again, it goes right. to the culture of fear and the culture of violence. We live in a society, and this is why Commissioner Timoney's points are so on point, right. because essentially he's saying, look at how difficult it is for us to get our institutions to not be biased, our institutions right. to use lethal force when it's appropriate. If we can't even control our institutions, how in the world can we empower citizens to make these kinds of subjective judgments? It's very, very dangerous. We need to look at what's behind it, though. We need to look at the legislators behind it. What is their rationale? What's the money behind it? Why is the NRA involved? Those are the questions that I'd like to see answered out of this Trayvon Martin case.
Let me quote John Timoney a little bit more, Dave, and I'll put this to you. Mm-hmm. And he also writes, I also asked the bill's sponsor, State Representative Dennis Baxley, to point out any case in Florida where a homeowner had been indicted or arrested as a result of defending his castle, in quotations. He could not come up with a single one. Right.
Yeah, right. It doesn't happen. And we have to stress this point. People who are attacked have a right to use self-defense.
Sure,
nobody
right.
is saying that, you know, if somebody right. comes up to you and assaults you either in a mild way or in a very serious way, you can't use self-defense, mm-hmm. nor is anybody saying you can't use deadly force if, in fact, that's necessary to protect your life or somebody else's life. The problem with this Florida statute is it creates situations where you can now walk into a situation, think that there's a need for deadly force when there is none. Look at the facts here, absolutely none. And then afterwards, the police think you're immune from prosecution.
Right.
That's right.
Just a quick follow-up, if you don't mind, but talk about the Pennsylvania Castle Doctrine signed by the governor last June.
So Pennsylvania passed what I call a modified Stand Your Ground law, which is similar to Florida, but there's a limitation here. You can only stand your ground and use deadly force in Pennsylvania in this kind of situation when the other person is actually armed. So
and
it's
you have
not
to see
just
it. Right.
that's
to
right.
See
that's
weapon.
Right. They have to have a firearm or a replica of a firearm, so that it's a situation where you've got to know, as opposed right. to I think he's a young kid, hoodie,
right.
you know,
right.
neighborhood with a lot of crime, as they say, and therefore he's probably armed. So it's not guesswork.
Go ahead.
There's another piece of that too, because if the person is leaving your home, as opposed to threatening you, you don't have the right to shoot him. Then I know people find that odd, but that's true, because he's no longer
he's
a threat
retreating.
To you. He's retreating. But also here, when you put citizens with that type of law and without some serious education, some serious training, the type of stuff we do here in Philadelphia where we're meeting with our people on a monthly basis, providing in-service training, you're putting folks out where they do develop those negative attitudes, as you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. They develop those perceptions of people. And then you're saying, okay, it's okay for you to kill. And if we want to change this climate of violence and change this culture, we have to also make sure our laws are reflective of that. The mm-hmm. purpose of our police department is to provide us with a service. They are not your protector per se, but they provide you protection because of the service they provide. Our job, even in Town Watch, is to make sure officers go home at night. I say a boring night is the best night you can have on Town Watch patrol, because that meant nothing happened on your watch. Mm. But if it happens, you observe it, you document it, you report it, the police will handle it. That's the partnership you have, and that's how community policing comes about.
James, let me turn to you, because we've been focusing largely on George Zimmerman, but I want to make sure we don't forget Trayvon Martin.
That's right.
Obviously,
that's right.
shot and killed by George Zimmerman, but his body was held for several days, his parents frantically looking for him.
That's right.
His body was held as a John Doe for several days.
That's right. We have a lot of questions that need to be answered by the Sanford Police Department. This is why Chief Lee stepped aside, so that we can get to the core of what's going on here. Obviously, they drug tested the corpse. They did a background check on Trayvon Martin, who was dead. They did not drug test or do an alcohol test on Mr. Zimmerman. They did not do a background check on Mr. Zimmerman. They kept the body in the morgue for 3 or 4 days as a John Doe, so they didn't use the telephone to try to find out. And all of this is, and this is important to note here, all of these sort of institutional biases that we see, they don't really have a lot to do with who the perpetrator is or who the race of the perpetrator is, because unfortunately, even black folk have some of these same exact biases. We live in a society that demonizes young black men. So any of us, many of us, might look at a black male as being more suspicious. And so in that environment, we need police officers to really be brought to task on some of these policy and some of these policing issues. And obviously, the Sanford Police Force has a lot of questions to answer on this issue.
And you've been intimately involved in police cases, David.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an interesting question is, what if the police had gotten involved here, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, it's we see a lot of cases where they get these kind of calls. There's a suspicious-looking person in the neighborhood. It's 11 o'clock at night. He's walking around. He looks like he's up to no good. That's not criminal. That's
right.
Not ground for
That's
a stop.
Right.
It's not grounds for a frisk. Now, the police can come and observe, right? They can have kind of just an encounter and maybe ask him, you know, what are you doing here? But they can't stop him. They can't frisk him. And yet, in a lot of these situations, if what had happened here was the police actually had time to respond, I'll bet that department would have stopped and frisked him, right?
Yeah.
For no reason. Now, it's much better than being killed. I mean,
yeah,
that would have
true.
Been a
right.
much better result. But there, it's the same kind of stereotype.
That's right.
And the notion is, well, even if it's only one of the 100 cases, one of the 150 cases, maybe we'll find a gun, right? And that, unfortunately, is what fuels policing sometimes in this kind of situation, and that's the stop and frisk problem.
But
nine out of ten people who've been stopped and frisked are innocent.
And are not carrying any weapons.
That's right.
See, they're not of any danger because you use a – we don't like to say the word, but you profile people.
Mm-hmm.
And when you profile people, you use your stereotypes and use your own prejudice. Let's also be fair. Fair in the sense that all of us come with a certain set of prejudice.
That's right.
All of us do. The object is when you get in law enforcement, just like when we get people into our Town Watch training, we want them to recognize that you have the biases. And now you have to work beyond that and away from it. But because we don't, and then we say, okay, look at the YouTube, look at the videos, look at the rap videos, and then we try to capitalize all of that and say, this shapes what a young black male is. It does not. Out of all of the crime that takes place, it's only 10% out of our entire population that are problematic.
That's right.
Only 10%. So I got 90% on the plus side. Okay, I got 90% plus, and then you're going to shape an image of me based on the 10%. It's no different than when you shape a perspective of white people based on a 10% who act a certain way. If we do that and we become the dominant society, what would be different? If the object is to make this a more harmonious place for us to live and grow, as we address eradicate the culture of violence, we also must eradicate the culture of racism and the culture of prejudice. We have to begin to address it and talk about these things.
And let me just quickly reintroduce the three of you, and I do want to get some callers in on the conversation, talking about, frankly, what the country is talking about, the shooting death of Trayvon Martin by a neighborhood watch captain, or at least informal captain, George Zimmerman in Florida. It was a month ago, and the voice you just heard is Anthony Murphy, executive director of Town Watch Integrated Services, James Peterson, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, and David Rudofsky, a civil rights lawyer here in Philadelphia at Carey's Rudofsky, Messing, and Feinberg. We have just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get, looks like Sandra from Wilmington to join our conversation. Sandra, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for featuring this extremely important case today, the New Age Emmett Till case. It reminds me of so much. I have a couple of very quick points.
Sure.
One, this blaming the victim mentality that's accompanying this perceived dangerousness of black and Latino men in hoodie is very reminiscent of women who wear stilettos and short skirts and plunged necklines being the blame for their rape. So I wanted to make that point. Secondly, I found it extremely fascinating when I heard on NPR the other day that psychological research is due to be released this month that indicates that when people have a gun in their possession, they actually, through experiments, have been found to perceive the person carrying some sort of object as that object being a gun as well. Those without a weapon on their possession do not, but those with a weapon are more likely to perceive whatever that is, be it, you know, Skittles or anything else, as also being a gun. I wonder if your guests could comment
sure.
on that.
Well, and we did touch on that, but let me pick up on the Emmett Till comment that you made, James Peterson. Do you see parallels?
Well, I want to be really careful about making these kinds of historical analogies, but there are some things that do maintain here. One, the outrage and our response to it is comparable and similar. And then, you know, when a life is lost and it seems like such a sheer waste and it's done in such a violent way, way, that also causes us to react. And then remember, it's a failure of the justice system. You know, the Emmett Till piece is also a failure, an historic failure of the justice system. Same piece here. What's interesting and what we need to claim as being distinct is in the time of Emmett Till, this miscarriage of justice would have ran right up through the state government.
And clearly that was the all-white jury.
Yes, and that's not going to be the case here. But obviously, the feds are involved. The states, they switched states' attorneys. Governor Scott has been doing the media rounds. And so I think that we have to at least acknowledge the fact that there will be some different responses in the criminal justice system. Remember those guys who were exonerated for the murder and torture of Emmett Till sold their story for $10,000 to a magazine as soon as they were out of court.
Yeah. There is something
worse about state-coordinated violence based on race. I mean, when you had a total breakdown in Mississippi, the Emmett Till case, which is the classic case of someone framed for a crime he didn't do and railroaded through the system.
He whistled at a white woman.
That's right. I mean, as bad as this case is, there's something qualitatively different about the state organizing that kind of racism and that kind of denial of justice. Right. I think we're somewhat beyond that, although we still see some cases where the race issue is raised in criminal proceedings, but we ought to keep that in mind.
Really quick about the slut walk reference is important as well, because I am interested in the ways in which we can tie together some of the institutional and systemic things that are important here. And the caller was right that there is a connection between the ways in which the hoodie has been talked about and the ways in which women dressed have been talked about, as somehow sartorial choices then indicate whether or not you can be violently acted upon. The thing to keep in mind here is that while we want to be vigilant about those things, we don't want to capitulate to them, right? So Geraldo Rivera talking about the ways in which the hoodie is more important than the race is absolutely absurd. That's not the point of wearing the hoodies. The point is to draw attention to the fact that what people wear does not determine whether or not you can be violent against them.
You want
and Todd, agree with both points, because realistically, I wouldn't want to make a connection between what happened with Emmett Till and what happened to Trayvon Martin, but because I don't want us to lose focus on the Trayvon Martin situation. I don't want us to lose focus on the situation that shows us for today, that any young black male, college grad, businessman, walking the street, going to the store, wearing a hoodie, someone perceive him as a danger just because he's walking, and then someone decides to kill him, take his life in that moment, and realize the impact of that. And I want you to realize the impact that has on young black men across the state, across this country. See, when you look at these demonstrations now, and they're saying demonstration, they're going to wear the hoodie. It's not the hoodie. What they're saying to you is you're not going to be able to put us in that bag and say, because I wear this garment, you have a right to take my life. No, that's the challenge here. We want to speak not just to the situation with Trayvon Martin, but we wanted to speak to all the Trayvon Martins across this country. We are not going to allow us to begin put in that bag where you take, say, oh, because you wear a hoodie, you this. No, oh, you wear your pants low. I happen to be against wearing your pants low. I am. I'm sorry.
The thing is that it's okay to be against it, but we can't have municipal laws and legislation against wearing your pants low, because it feeds into this entire system. We can't say that just because someone sags their pants, wears a hoodie, has dreads, that they're all of a sudden a criminal. And unfortunately, there are too many institutions at play here. Criminal justice, police forces, schools, too many institutions at play that already have these biases, so we cannot feed them.
And that's the idea, is to make that change and to bring that back into focus. And so that, no, I won't compare it to Emmett Till, but I will say the situation still smacks at me, the mere fact that a young black child's life was taken.
David, we're almost up at a break here, but some have talked about the hoodie and the hijab. I mean, the idea that what people wear, we make all sorts of judgments and stereotypes appearances.
We definitely do, and it's sometimes it's personal prejudice. But I think the point that's well made is that when the government buys into that, when those who have power buy into that as signals of criminality, that's the problem, and that's why good training, for example, put aside Town Watch. Good training of police is not what they're wearing. Are they doing something objectively that you can say that's criminal versus he just happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time?
And that's David Rudofsky joins us along with James Peterson and Anthony Murphy. We are talking about the shooting death of Trayvon Martin and the issues it raises related to race and gun laws and civil rights. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yefim Bronfman joins the Philadelphia Orchestra for Bartok's second piano concerto, Bruntman won a Grammy for his performance of this work. Also, Gilbert Varga conducts Stravinsky's Petrushka. Tickets online or at 215-893-1999. April 12th, 13th, and 14th at the Kimmel Center, Bruntman plays Bartok plus Petrushka with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
After Sunday's long-awaited season premiere of Mad Men, fans of the show will be eager to talk about it. On the next Fresh Air, we talk all about the new episode with executive producer Matthew Weiner, who wrote it and created the show. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Alzheimer's. It's almost always a family affair that leaves us with many unexpected responsibilities. It can be painful to care for a loved one who's spiraling downward, experiencing memory loss, disorientation, and rapid behavioral changes. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, Alzheimer's and the Emotional Toll on Families. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with David Rudofsky, a civil rights lawyer here in Philadelphia. James Peterson, he's director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, and Anthony Murphy, executive director of Townwatch Integrated Services. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Elizabeth from Radnor to join us on Radio Times. Elizabeth, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
One of you mentioned that Stand Your Ground doesn't protect George Zimmerman because he initiated the confrontation. And I'm not a lawyer, but I've read this law over and over again, and it says nothing about forfeiting your right to claim self-defense if you are the one provoking the confrontation. I think where Zimmerman runs into trouble is the reasonable part. You know, I don't think he was reasonably in fear of his life while confronting an unarmed 17-year-old, but I really do think that the problem is with the law, because, you know, you saw a couple weeks ago the gentleman who was had his car radio stolen, and he chased down the thief and stabbed him in an alley, you know, and the thief wasn't, you know, didn't initiate the confrontation, and he was acquitted. I mean, the judge even threw out the case.
Well, Elizabeth, we do have a lawyer here. Yeah. I'm going to go to David Rudofsky.
We just may have some disagreement on that statute. Probably can't resolve it on this program. But as I read it, if somebody initiates the violence, initiates an unlawful contact, they can't then say, well, the other person came at me, and therefore I can stand my ground. I don't think Florida's position is that. It's that if you are innocent, you're in a situation where somebody comes at you, even if you could retreat without any risk to your life, you can stand your ground and use deadly force. But you are right. I mean, the problem here is that he had, whatever the interpretation is, he, from what we know so far, I think, had no reasonable basis to believe that Trayvon Martin was going to use deadly force against him. I mean, that's what's missing here. There's no necessity, because you've stopped a young kid. He's not armed. He's simply walking through in the neighborhood. There's no indication other than he's got a hand in his waistband. No indication of a weapon,
phone,
right?
Yeah.
Other than, I assume he's got a weapon because he's in the wrong place and he's a young black kid.
That's right. I mean, the bottom
James
line
Peterson.
Here is that I think the caller is right, that we do have to focus on the law because we want to look at what the policies are that fed into this, but it does not apply here. The spirit of the law, I think, is even off base, which is why I want to reveal what's going on behind the scenes of the law, because when you have 40% decline in the state of Florida in crime, and crime nationally is declining, why do we need a stand your ground law? I mean, what if the spirit of it is in self-defense, why can't it be more properly legislated so that we don't have these kinds of tragic accidents occurring?
Well, let me turn to you, Anthony Murphy, because and you're the director of Townwatch Integrated Services here in the Philadelphia area, supporting something like 700 neighborhood watch groups. Is this an aberration, what we're talking about, the idea that someone who's affiliated with some kind of a neighborhood or town watch, essentially taking the law into their own hands?
I think it is as it relates to Philadelphia. I think it is as it relates to the type of training that is provided for our town watch groups here in the city, that it's an aberration, because the object is very strictly to enforce certain rules. No guns, no weapons. You have young ladies, and we do training, we tell them, don't carry any mace because you're not trained on how to use it, so you don't carry mace. So you don't go out on patrol if you take an aspirin. If you take an aspirin because you have a cold, we don't want you on the street. We want you to stay home because it could impair your judgment. We have it so that there's patrols. It's not one person by his or health or one woman by themselves. It's a patrol group. And they have the ability to communicate with each other. We provide them with radio communication so that they can communicate Town Watch person to Town Watch person and to their base unit. And therefore, the base unit makes the call to 911 based on a suspicious person. So, yes, it's an aberration for here. Unfortunately, that law that you have there in Florida, for all of the conversation about it, it would not be an aberration because that law says I can arm myself. I've had Town Watch groups who are security guards, and they say, well, I'm coming home from work. I'm going on patrol. Leave your gun at home. They say, what if I leave it in the trunk of my car? Do you have the key to the trunk? I mean, because you have access, you can get it. Right. See, so it is once you interject the weapon, you change the mindset. And if we're going to really work to kind of restructure this and even looking at why the law was done, why the law says what it says, what's behind the law, I mean, we will find some very interesting things. Mm-hmm. The object now is we must change the law. Mm. And see, and you change the law so that it does not allow you to interject yourself in a situation and then kill someone.
David, we had an interesting email from Eric from Philadelphia. Said, since Zimmerman was following Martin, did Trayvon Martin have any rights to stand his ground using force to defend himself under the Florida statute?
Well, it's a very good question. And if Trayvon Martin was approached by Zimmerman and Zimmerman was acting in an aggressive fashion and threatened deadly force, Martin could have used deadly force by standing his ground. Mm-hmm. I suspect if that's what had happened, he would have been arrested in this situation.
Why, right? Why do you suspect that?
I think just the combination of race, the combination of neighborhood. Yeah. He wouldn't have gotten the benefit of the doubt.
And
right?
We have evidence by how they acted. They maintained him as a John Doe. Right. They drug tested him and did a background check on him. They didn't do any of those things for Mr. Zimmerman. We have evidence institutionally in what the police did and did not do that they may have acted
But the point is right. He could have used, and we wouldn't want Trayvon Martin to use deadly force in that situation just because he thought, you know, this guy Zimmerman, he's following me. What's going on here? Don't use deadly force unless you think the other person's about to use deadly force. Both sides.
Let me get, looks like Carl from West Oak Lane to join us. And Carl, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I think this chain of events could only have happened because of institutional racism that exists in this country. And, I mean, from the point of Zimmerman assuming that he could do what he did, the fact that he took the man's life, mm-hmm. the fact that the police did not pursue him, the fact that it took over a month for this to come to light, mm-hmm. and the fact that even on NPR and other media, you know, Zimmerman is described as a Town Watch captain, right. which it was determined fairly early on that he never got Town Watch training. Yeah. And that's just giving him some credibility.
Fair enough,
so,
and I use those words. No, I'm glad you did, Carl. Let me actually toss it over to you, James Peterson.
Agree? Carl was absolutely right. I've been in national media trying to make the case that he is not Neighborhood Watch, he's not Town Watch, he's not affiliated with any of those organizations. He's never been trained to do their work. He was considered as such by the neighborhood, but that is not a formal thing. But the caller is absolutely right here that it's the institutional racism that creates an environment where these things kind of happen, which is why, while for all that we want to focus on Trayvon and support his family and pay attention to this tragedy, we cannot lose sight of the institutions that are at work here as well, because we can't let the institutions off the hook.
Well, Carl, I'm guilty as charged because I did describe him as a member of a Town Watch organization. I mean, are there freelancers, Anthony Murphy, that are doing Town Watch?
In the city of Philadelphia?
Well, I don't know.
The answer's got to be no, right?
In the city of Philadelphia, my answer is no, they're not freelance. They reach out to us. Even the police refer them to us if they go that way. They reach out to all the neighbors, and they search. We're kind of very visible in the city. So, no, I would venture to say that even throughout the country, they try to make everyone obtain a certain amount of training, a certain amount of education. I prefer the word education than training, but given a certain amount of education as to do's and don'ts. I would say that the Philadelphia program, and not just because I'm the executive director, but because I know it well, it is absolutely the best because it absolutely gives you criteria. It gives you guidelines, and we absolutely will decertify you from being a Town Watch person and not allow you to participate. See, so there's consequences for your actions if you go on the other side. And since we look at this as really making people a part of the community policing philosophy. Community policing is the community participating in the policing of itself. So that if I pick trash up off my street, I am helping to maintain a cleanliness. If I interact with the young people in my community, I am helping keep them in the right direction. It takes the village to raise the child. So if we do this, and then as we patrol our streets, watch our streets, observe things that are happening that are incorrect, and we report them so that law enforcement can do their job.
Let me get, looks like LaVon from Lehigh University to join us on Radio Times. Hi, LaVon, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I actually just had a really quick comment regarding the Stand Your Ground law, but I also had a question for the panel.
Sure.
So my comment was, with laws like Stand Your Ground, I feel as though it kind of gives individuals a right who already harbor certain resentments to put themselves in a situation of danger so that they can act out in the way that they already want to and be justified. Because I'm not a psychoanalyst, but you can infer from Mr. Zimmerman's release call that he was setting the stage for self-defense plea. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, my question to the panel was, how do you feel that if Mr. Zimmerman does go in front of a jury, that he may be found innocent because of cases like, you know, Oscar Grant and Casey Peterson that are highly racialized and politicized? Juries tend to, I don't know if they, you know, freeze up or whatever, but when the cases get this much national media, sometimes it has a bad outcome for justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we were actually talking about whether Zimmerman could get a fair trial or not, assuming he goes to trial. But, David, your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't want to prejudge this case. I think our point is that Zimmerman should not be immune from prosecution,
right.
Which it appears he has been up to this point. There's certainly grounds to arrest him under the Florida law. He ought to be tried. Whether he can get a fair trial, it'll be difficult to pick a jury, but we do it all the time in terrorism cases and others. You can get a jury that will say, hopefully, and will also apply it, that I can be fair, I'll listen to the evidence. Zimmerman may have some defenses that we don't know. I don't want to prejudge him. We also want to be thinking about the rights of people who are accused and not just railroad them through the system. Mm-hmm. But I think, based on what we know, a fair verdict would find him guilty of some level of homicide, whether it's manslaughter or something else. I don't know. I don't know enough about it. But we get results sometimes we don't like, but the best we can do is give a fair trial and hope the truth comes out.
And I concur with that, because we can't judge it. We're not going to be there. But the object is, from the Town Watch point, because they kept pointing out, the Neighborhood Watch, his actions were all wrong.
Mm-hmm. Let me get, looks like Isabella from Philadelphia to join us on Radio Times. Isabella, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there. I want to speak to a little bit about the institutions cultivating a culture of fear. And in the Philadelphia Inquirer this morning, it was kind of actually ironic. There was, in the front page, two articles. Of course, the sad story of Trayvon Martin, but also the story of Kevin Neary, who was profiled because he was white and he was shot. And the perpetrator said that he targeted this man because he was white. And it kind of, you know, the media has some responsibility for perpetuating this culture of fear. Prior to George Zimmerman's family coming out and saying that he was multiracial and of Hispanic descent, it was said that this was a white man who shot an unarmed black man. And, you know, I want to speak to that a little bit.
Isabella, I'm glad you raised it, because I think it's an important issue, and I'm going to toss that to you, James.
Sure. Peterson. Well, you can be Hispanic, and you can be black or white. Hispanic's not a racial designation. I think the caller is right that we want to be vigilant and identify all the institutions that are involved, and obviously the media plays the role. I'm not familiar with the Neary case, but when we look historically, young black men have been profiled, murdered, and the miscarriage of justice has been directed at black and brown males especially, but also just black and brown folk particularly, for a long, long time now. So that's the reason why we're talking about this case. Thankfully, profiling based on being white is much more of an anomaly. And unfortunately, we need to have that kind of balance across different racial demographics. But you can be Hispanic black or Hispanic white, Latino black or Latino white.
But just picking up on that, James, when you look at black victims, the perpetrators tend to be black as well.
This is the big takeaway for us. So to the extent that we're all galvanized around this issue and we're valuing this life, I'm challenging my community to value black life this way every time out. So we need to say that. And that is an important piece. But listen, there are so many structural things at play: poverty, education, access to guns. There's so many different things at play that we need to address to serve that situation, that I would hope that folk would take this moment and take this energy to look at the bigger picture.
Go ahead,
and actually, since you raised the point of the black on black crime, again, percentages make a great deal of difference. And realize that, yes, there is black-on-black crime. And one of the things we're doing here in the city of Philadelphia is a group of us formed a coalition, and we called it, it's a 2012 Live and Let Live campaign. Mm-hmm. So we want to push the message, live and let live. Because although young men, when they're armed, that carrying that gun does promote you to use the gun. Unfortunately, if you're involved in illegal entrepreneurship, that also promotes you to use the gun. But when there's a black male to another black male, I'm asking black males across the city of Philadelphia and across your listening audience to live and let live. And we want to take this message from 2012 and begin to really address the eradication of the culture of violence and eradicate the culture of fear.
Let me squeeze one more caller on. We have Ed from Booth Wynn joining us on Radio Times. Ed, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I have a question and a comment. My question is that... is the panel and is the public misguided, focusing on the state of ground law when neighbors called 911 because they heard Trayvon screaming, and clearly you could hear on some of the 911 tape, you could hear this kid screaming, help, help, before the gun went off? And secondly,
Ed, only because that's such an important part of our conversation, and I want to give our guests a chance to weigh in on that. I'll start with you, David. We don't know specifically who's screaming, but we hear screaming on
that's
that
right.
tape.
We hear the screaming. It looks like it's from Martin. I mean, again, there are some facts that we don't have nailed down 100%
right.
because all the information has not been provided. Unfortunately, the police investigation didn't start until much later than it should
right.
have.
Mm-hmm.
You lose evidence sometimes. Yeah. People's memories then, a few days later, tend to get a little less sharp. So, even that prejudices the case. But from everything, at least what I've read, and I represent criminal defendants, I tend to say, prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. But everything here says to me there's grounds for an arrest.
Yeah, I mean, again, the caller draws attention to something we talked about earlier, which is I would caution your viewers that listening to the 911 tapes can be a haunting and harrowing experience. But if you listen to them, you will see that Mr. Zimmerman's actions terrorized that community. So the people are calling, they're scared, they're fearful of their own lives. These are people in the community that he's allegedly protecting. And I think that is the sort of most compelling evidence to me that, one, the law needs to be changed, and two, that Mr. Zimmerman needs to be prosecuted for murder.
Well, we could go on. The clock tells me we need to end our conversation. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. And our guests have been Anthony Murphy, Executive Director of Townwatch Integrated Services, training and supporting over 700 watch groups here in the Philadelphia area. Nice to have you back. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times. We'll probably
look
have you back.
Thank you.
And James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies, also Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, a blogger for Huffington Post. Nice to have you back with us
Thank
on Radio
you.
Times as well. And David, always a pleasure. David Rudofsky, civil rights lawyer at Carey's Rudofsky, Messing, and Feinberg, a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. David, thanks very much.
All right, good to be here.
And go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show, is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder, with assistance from Jonathan Best. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.